Just a little quick quiz to see if we remember something from the morning session. When should revision begin? When you're on the incline, exactly. When should redevelopment begin? Absolutely. The closer you get to decline and the end, what does that mean? No vision, and it's going to be harder work, right? It's going to be harder work. It's going to call for more severe action. It's a principle that's applied in business called jumping the curve, by the way, when business gets stagnant. And there's actually a book in the bibliography in the back called Jumping the Curve. That's exactly what we're looking at, is when you get up to that peak, you jump that curve, and you don't wait to just ride that wave to shore, so to speak. You've got to even catch a bigger one, because ultimately, you get there, and it will finally deposit you. And that's not what we're going to do in terms of a church life. The next section is really for the priests to fill out, this 3-3. So we're not going to take time to do it now. It's a 5-minute exercise, fathers. But it's really asking you, and I'll walk through the questions. I want you to think back of when you originally were dealing with your call to the priesthood, and how did you envision serving God at that time? That's very important. But then how do you describe your current ministry? And is there any connection? Do you see it as a fulfillment? Do you see it as a frustration? Do you see it as a dream unfulfilled? These are critical issues that every pastoral leader has to ask himself and keep asking himself. And then the second question is, take 5 minutes to look ahead to your future ministry with your current church. And what is your vision of the desired future? That's real key. You have to have that, because you have to take that vision and share it and build on it, presuming it's a godly vision. And you have to be willing to lead. If a priest says, well, gee, I don't know what to do, or I don't know where we're going to go, that's not a good recipe for moving forward. Okay? Now, it's not a vision to come in and say, this is what we're going to do, and lay down the law like that, because if it's a godly vision, it will be able to be caught by other people, not imposed on other people. And that's a critical distinction in leadership, of having people catch the vision rather than having it imposed. Because if it's imposed, what happens? There will be initial resistance anyway, but an imposed vision will not be embraced by the people. And you also have to think of it this way. How do you start a fire? Where do you light the match? If you have a pile of wood, either in your fireplace or a bonfire, where do you strike the match and set the fire? Why at the very bottom? Fire burns up, right? You know, you try to cheat on that sometimes, and you pour what my son's called Boy Scout juice, which is lighter fluid, on top of the fire. And what happens to that? It burns off on the surface, and you still don't have a fire going later. Now, a lot of church initiatives and things like that, either in the parish or in wider levels, fail precisely for that reason. It's something that is imposed from the top, and it's like pouring lighter fluid and trying to start the fire rather than letting the natural principles of thermodynamics light the fire. It's always built at the base. And so a visionary leader has to be people, a person who is willing to build up his people so that they follow. So that's just something to remember. What I want us to look on is now page 3-4. There really are gaps in our ministry, experience as pastors, but also as lay leaders. Because the big gap is between having the accidental ministry, which is how we normally do ministry, and intentional ministry, and that's how we have to learn to do ministry. Because somewhere in the past, there was, in our own approach to ministry, This is how we've tended to do it, and I'm repeating myself, but we have responded to needs, but maybe not with a consistent plan or an all-encompassing vision or purpose. And so we do a little of this, and we do a little of that, but we don't do it intentionally by targeting a people, a need, a group. I will say our churches were founded, however, on an intentional ministry basis. You can look at the cornerstones of any one of our churches, and you can tell exactly what their intentional focus in ministry was. On Orthodox churches, it will be stated very clearly. And at one time, there was an intentional focus on X given people of X ethnic background. That was a good thing. That was a good thing. Because it was this principle at work. Focusing, and we're focusing on a certain group of people. What happens is, if you outgrow or outlive or whatever, move beyond that original focus group, if you don't revision, if you don't re-strategize, then you're no longer doing ministry any longer intentionally, but we tend to lapse into the accident. And there can be a gap between what we envision and what we actually vision. We get caught up in that. That's sometimes the frustration of the clergy, how they envisioned ministry when they left seminary, what they were going out to do, and that gets tempered with reality. And it gets tempered because normally they go into parishes that already have existing structures in place. Sometimes the clergy are saying, oh my goodness, my vision for ministry is not maybe anything of what these structures are allowing me to do. There can be frustration. And so much the challenge for us is to learn how to do ministry and refocus our energy by doing it intentionally. Remember I said that the Lord, when he sent the apostles out, gave them an intentional focus for ministry to Jerusalem first and Judea, literally to the Jews. But he says in Samaria, and then finally to the ends of the earth. Now, there was an intentional strategy. It was one of widening the circle of influence. That's really key to doing ministry and doing it well. We find out, though, when we look at the book of Acts, the apostles needed their own prodding. Their own prodding. The apostles had not taken the gospel into Samaria, by the way, voluntarily. Remember what happens? Stephen is martyred. And with the martyrdom of Stephen, the church, which had been focused solely in Jerusalem, starts to be scattered. And some of those people end up in Samaria. And what are we told? But they're preaching the word to none but the Jews only. They are not even preaching to anyone else, not even to the Samaritans by implication. It's finally as the church gets driven into the Gentile parts of the world, like Antioch, and we find proselytes, we find God-fearers coming to the synagogues, that they're first called Christians in Antioch because they first start making Gentile converts. So sometimes there's even prodding in history that gets people to focusing intentionally on new groups. But do a cursory read of the book of Acts, and you'll see how sometimes the church needed its own prodding, or through circumstances of history, the church was prodded into expanding its vision and moving beyond. They were having issues in the church in Jerusalem, the issue of feeding the widows, and it was an issue based on the linguistic and ethnic differences between two different groups of Jews. We read this on Sunday, the Barbarian Women, and the establishment of the diaconate. Remember, in that issue, the church was growing, they were taking care of widows, but the Greek-speaking Jewish widows said they weren't getting the same amount of food rations that the local Aramaic-speaking Palestinian Jewish widows were receiving. And there started to be a conflict, even in the early church, based on some ethnic and linguistic differences. But what happens is the apostles say, hey, we can't stop preaching the word to minister tables. Five to seven men, wisdom and the Holy Spirit, whom we may appoint to this ministry, and they chose Stephen, deacon of Timon, and the rest as the first of the deacons. But interestingly, we're never told in that section that the widows were fed. We're never told that the widows were fed. What Luke writes is that the church started multiplying. Because the apostles said, all right, this is the strategy you need to take. Remember, you have a strategy to fulfill a purpose there. You take the strategy, we'll have some people who are dedicated to serving the widows. So what? So our priorities can remain the gospel. We're never told they get fed. We're just told that the church starts to grow even more. That is always something that we need to look at as we look in our own parish life. What is our priority? Is it the gospel? Or are we getting bogged down serving the tables because we're doing accidental ministry? Yeah, we've got to do this. And I know we've got to do that. And yes, we've got to do this other. But do we do it in such a way that we really free up the clergy and others who are called to the more apostolic ministry of preaching and teaching so that these other things are getting done? Because that's really the difference between ministering accidentally and ministering intentionally. Most of the time when we do accidental ministry, we expect the priest to do it. Remember, if you don't need to be ordained to do it, the priest doesn't need to be doing it. And that normally means there's a layperson in your church who is qualified to do that or can become qualified and should be doing it. Because your ultimate goal should be to have as many of your laity involved in doing as many of the ministries in the life of the church as possible, so that the priest can be free to do what his job is spiritually and liturgically in the life of the parish. And most pastors, most churches are caught in that gap between envisioning and visioning. In other words, envisioning what we thought for the future and then what we're actually doing. And so the vision never fulfills itself. There are important questions to look at. Let's cover about all the blanks. Where are you? Where are you in your church life? How did you get there? How did you get there? More importantly, why do you stay there? If you can say, gee, we're in recline, the question is, why do you stay there? If you're in decline, why do you stay there? Ask yourself this, no matter where you found yourself in the life cycle of your church, where do you want to be? Where do you want to be? And be very careful and say, well, we want to be like we used to be. That's not going to happen. You can't become what you used to be. You can become something new. Remember Lot's wife? The Lord said, I'm leading you out of where you are. Don't look back. He didn't tell her what was going to happen to her. He just said, don't look back. She paused. She looked back. You can read a lot of that passage. The important thing is, when God leads us from someplace, he's not going to lead us back to that place in the same way. So, ask yourself those five questions. And remember, the answer is always going to be in the biblical purpose of the church. And we looked at one of these things, Matthew 28, 18 through 20. And the other important scripture to look at and study for its implications, and also Father Hopko really works that one over in his article, the Parish, it's Acts chapter 2, verses 39 through 47. Which has a passage in it, and they continued steadfastly and the apostles' teaching and fellowship, the breaking of bread and the prayers. And they had all things in common, and they had favor amongst all the people, and they were taking care of the needs of each by through their own substance. They were continuing daily in one accord in the temple, and the Lord was adding what? Daily to the church, such as should be saved. And that's really the key. And to say, and look, and there are really eight essential elements that any church growth writer, no matter what his background, will look at that passage and say there were eight key things that they were doing here. And it's not to say that this is a formula. It is to say this is a description of authentic Christian behavior in parish life. That we are united in the Eucharist, that we are united in apostolic teaching, that we share certain core common values about who we are, and that yet we're not, and we're focused on the needs of our own members, and yet we're focused on the needs of those people who aren't our own members. Because we see what's happening in the book of Acts on the day following Pentecost is that people start coming into the church in Jerusalem, bringing their sick, bringing their poor. But they start coming in from all over Judea. Judea was coming to Jerusalem, in fact, because of the life in the church. There's a sociologist who used to be associated with Princeton named Rodney Stark. Rodney Stark wrote a book called The Rise of Christianity. It's maybe about 10 years ago or something. And he looked at it from, at the time, of really a non-believer who was a sociologist. His conclusion was that the gospel grew the greatest in the first 300 years of Christian history, not because of the teaching and preaching, but because of the authentic living that was going on in Christian communities, which commended itself to people of the Roman Empire. It's an incredible look. And so that's one of the things we have to be aware of, is if we are authentically living our lives as Christians, it is going to be something that commends itself to the neighborhood, the community, people around us. He goes on to state, you know, women were attracted to Christianity. You notice so many of the early church leaders, and we talk about the saints of that period, were women. And they were women coming in from a society that saw them as basically their husband's property. Their husbands could divorce them at will. The husbands, if they were Roman citizens, could have their wives killed at will. Their children could be exposed and just left to die. And yet they found a radical new life in Christianity. Christian women were not treated. So I commend that to you, because our life now is more than the life before Constantine. We are aliens. Our values are not the values of the world around us. Our values are the values of the kingdom of God. But we don't have a culture that really supports our view of reality. So we have to so live our lives that other people around us see a different quality of life in how we live and how we treat each other, how we take care of our poor, how we take care of our sick as Christians, how we treat one another, so that it commends itself to a society that is in desperate need of exactly what we have to offer. I mean, we have to understand our faith is very countercultural. And see, 100 years ago, people were coming, and still, this was a countercultural faith 100 years ago for people who came to America. But in ways that are far more dire now than ever before. And it's going to take being intentional in the ministry. How we do that. Okay, we're going to flip over to 4:1. Hopefully by now you've developed some familiarity with the concepts we were using. Restart, life cycle perspective is driven by vision. incline is driven by vision and strategies to keep you on the vision, just like that passage in Acts 6 and the appointment of the deacons. That's exactly where you need to revision if you find yourself in incline. If you find yourself in recline, remember you're being strategy and structure driven. You're no longer being driven by vision. And to do that, you're going to have to deprogram yourself. Now, we think about deprogramming, don't we, when we, either in the computer world or we use that for people who have been rescued from cults. But sometimes we have to deprogram our own churches. And we have to say, how many programs do we have running? And you know, how many things do we have filling up our parish council, that on a parish calendar, that really aren't serving the original purpose anymore? And we say, gee, what was our original purpose? What was our original vision? Obviously, if you find yourself in decline, there's the need to destructure, because you're being driven by your structures. You aren't even driving your structures. And to restart its vision driven. One of the parishes I've already been with in the diocese in the last couple of weeks, they said, oh my goodness, here's where we are. They were able to see, my goodness, we're already, we have to start over. And that's really where we are. And I said, exactly. That's exactly where you are. And you have to start over. And then they started looking and says, by God's grace, they were already doing a number of the things that you would have to do in a church that was ready to start over, because it was having to regain the vision for what it was there for in the first place. Wherever you find your parish will determine its needs. If you look on page 4-2, you're going to have determined that your parish is obviously in one of three places. It's either in incline, recline, or decline. This is a chart to kind of reiterate just some of the things I shared with you a moment ago. The first and most serious issue is to make your diagnosis. Obviously, you can come here as leaders and you begin to make a diagnosis, but then you have to share that diagnosis with your parishes. That's the first step. And remember, just like in any time where we're intervening in any situation, there's always a tendency to greet a diagnosis that we don't like with what? Denial. Either, well, we're really not that bad, or we really don't need to do that, or whatever. But you know, if you're not what you were 10 years ago, and it's less than what you were 10 years ago, you have to admit that. You have to address the causes for it. And then you have to take positive steps to get a different result. Remember, in phase two, once you've diagnosed, your needs are going to be different. If you're in incline, you can revision. But if you're in recline, you've got to deprogram. And that means you have to look seriously at all the church programs, all the things that occupy your time. And if you're in decline, it's structure. And you've got to go down to just the bare bones and say, what really is our purpose and what is the minimal structure we need to get the job done? I got in an argument once with a senior priest. Well, I didn't get the argument. He picked it with me, the way I like to think about it. But I made the comment that, you know, again, on the day of Pentecost, we didn't find parish councils running churches. I figured this would be a layperson who would pick this up. It was picking. Father, we have to have parish councils. I said, well, yeah, we have to have them, but we have to have them because of American corporate law. That's why we have to have them. And the statute reflects that. Well, we have to have them. And I said, but what are they supposed to be doing? Well, we have to have them. You can't tell people they can't have them. And so we went on and on and on. And he was into the structure-driven, you know, model. Well, we have to have them. And I said, okay, if we have to have them, what is their purpose? When I went to State College, I already found that we had a parish council that was far too, you know, 8-member parish council in a church of 16 members or whatever. Now do the math on it. You think, this is a little bit much, a little bit top-heavy. I said, what are your purposes? Well, the treasurer counts the money. Okay. The secretary takes the minutes. Okay. What are your purposes? I had them do a self-study right off the bat. I said, you need to go and see, one, what your jobs are specified in the statute. And I said, two, what are the jobs we have here to be done? Well, the result was they reduced the membership by two, and as we ended up as a parish council, where everybody was elected to a job. Because we had four people in the parish council, their only job was to have an opinion. They had no job description. It was just four people who had no job description, four people had a job description. You see, the point was to tell them, we need a structure to get the jobs done. I said, what are the jobs that we need to do? Well, we need to take care of the building. Okay, that's one. We need to take care of the grounds. Okay, there's two. Well, we need someone to help the treasurer count the money so that the treasurer doesn't run off with the money. Okay, that's another one, you see. We started looking at it and decided, well, we don't need as many people. Okay. Because they were always griping, you know, even at that number. Obviously, it's hard to get people to serve on the parish council. But yeah. And it's harder if they don't have jobs to do and know what they're held accountable to do. So now, if you run for parish council in our parish, you run for a specific obligation or ministry. If you're in charge of grounds, that's pretty self-descriptive. If you run for, in terms of buildings, that's what you're running for. And then my approach in dealing with that structurally is that we don't come here to debate the obvious. We're not going to take a vote if the lawn needs to be mowed. Or get mowed. We're not going to debate on oiling hinges on the doors. You see, parish councils can bog down in the structure, and people are debating, you know, changing light bulbs. They're debating paying bills. You know? Because they don't have a functional structure. You need to ask yourself, do we have functional structures in our parishes? You have to answer that for your parish. Or do we kind of gum up the works because we're giving certain jobs to do and other people, they just have opinions? The idea behind our parish council, and I also told them, they were having three-hour meetings, by the way. And again, a church of 16 with three-hour meetings of a parish council without a priest. I said, well, my idea of a parish council night is 1 hour at the meeting, max. And then if we have an extra hour, we go drink beer. To me, that works. You know? That works. Not to do business, but just go drink beer. Because what do we need to do with our time? Are we really advancing the kingdom of God with 3 hour parish council meetings? Probably not. I think we can do more advancing the kingdom of God with drinking beer for an hour. I really do. But that's just a personal and lifestyle comment. But you see, don't you think you could do more for the kingdom of God having a beer with someone sometimes than sitting in a meeting that will last till midnight and you really wonder what you've done besides wasted your evening? See, people have lives. Let them live it. Don't bog them down in the structures of the church that aren't serving their purposes. So look at what you're doing. Look at how you're spending your time. And sometimes you say, my goodness, we're our own biggest enemies on this thing. Because who really wants to go to those parish council meetings? You know, I taught them, you don't need to make motions on the obvious. See? Did you know that? Even under Robert's Rules of Order, you don't have to have a motion to accept minutes. Did you realize that? You don't. Unless you need to change them, then you change them. Often we can get so encumbered with these things that we don't get the jobs done. And if we're in business or any place, you know, we have the same gripes about institutions there too. Are we streamlining the process? Our minutes come out electronically. Our minutes come out electronically like 30 minutes after the council meeting. All the council president does is ask, any change to the minutes, time they stand approved is read. Next.
extreme signs.
Reports have to come in writing. You know, and if you're reporting on your ministry, don't come and ask us permission to do something that you're supposed to be doing in terms of your job. Tell us what you've done. Tell us if you need more money. You have a budget. Spend it wisely. Spend it wisely. Do the job. Get the job done. That's the apostles' attitude towards structures in the church. Do what you need to do to get the job done so that the primary job of the church remains unfettered by structures. If you're into the third phase, if you're revisioning, you're going to innovate. If you're in recline, after you've deprogrammed, then that's where you start your revisioning. Don't try to revision until you've deprogrammed, because you will tend to just go back to those programs and kind of make your vision conform to the programs you already have in place. If you're in a serious decline, it's what we call authorization, because you've got to have real serious buy-in, and people have to give you permission as leaders to take the next steps. The next steps. Many times here, and when you're in serious decline, you hire an outside consultant to come in, because it's really the time for a serious intervention, and you need the outside consultant to come help you see with new eyes and to take the steps you need to take. Phase four, assimilation. If you get these things turned around, if your church is going to be functioning and healthy and growing again, you're going to have to deal with the people who start coming into the life of your parish. And how are you going to assimilate them? You might have a good way of taking care of the parishioners you have already, but can you assimilate the newcomer? Can you assimilate the newcomer if he comes from a different socioeconomic background, a different educational level, a different ethnic level? Do you have ways to do that? And sometimes these ways function naturally and very informally. And again, you don't need to gum up the works with establishing a committee for it. Okay? You know, do you have a way where people, we have some informal ways. We have a very multi-ethnic Orthodox church, because we get students from all over the world, and some of them are Orthodox. And so they come to everything from Russia and Ukraine to Cyprus and Greece, from Lebanon, from Africa, different places, and you know, plus we just have either faculty or staff in the university town, from Georgians to Romanians. We're all involved in our church life. And sometimes all it takes is me for saying, oh, so-and-so, someone is from Cluj, in other words, from Romania, someone is from, oh, okay, Father, I'll get them. That's all I have to do. And the assimilating starts working. You know? Oh, so-and-so is from Athens. Okay, Father, I'll take care of it. That type of thing works, and it's a natural bit of inclusion and assimilation. And it's very important to have. If you don't have it, or if you can't describe it, you need to institute it in some way. You know, who can take the newcomer and make the newcomer part of your life together? And just don't expect them to beat down the doors to feel at home at your church. They will not do that. Normally, what studies show is that people need to be able to make two or three significant friendships in the life of your church within 6 months' time, preferably in three. And if they can't do it in that period of time, they probably will be out of the back doors in the next 6 to 9 months. Because friendship and kinship has always spread the gospel. Look at last Sunday's gospel. The call of two sets of brothers. And of the apostles, three sets of brothers amongst the apostles. And you start reading it between the lines, and they also had economic connections with most of them, and friendship or kinship relations, if you start looking at who was related to whom amongst the apostles. And then friends started going to these, the Greeks started going to Philip and said, we would see Jesus. If you look at all those interconnections, patterns, you have to understand, you have to be willing to have those patterns. And then sometimes you already have them, and you just utilize them. And sometimes you have to establish a new way of entry, and to make sure that that person has a way to be brought in friendship and kinship. And with this, our coffee hours are probably the most underutilized and greatest potential for evangelism that we have, but we really don't have to do much more than have coffee hour. As long as we always, you know, like a Seder, leave a chair for the prophet Elijah at every table, for that stranger who might come in like a holy supper, and be willing to include in our friendship group some newcomer and make sure that we all reach out to them. Now, sometimes we have to be reminded of that. I know in our parish, some people say, well, Father, I'm concerned because there's a Russian table, and they're all speaking Russian over there. I said, yeah. And then he says, and then we've got the student table. It's just a bunch of students over there. Yeah. Well, and there's this table. There's just a bunch of these people over there. I said, yeah. And what are you? He says, well, I'm a university professor. And I said, what are you doing? I'm standing on the corner with a bunch of university professors. I said, yeah. He said, I guess I'm doing the same thing, aren't I? I said, yeah, you are. I said, that can be a good thing. That can be a bad thing. He finally said, oh, I get it. I said, yeah. I said, I love those tables at coffee hour because if I have a new Russian coming into the parish, if I can get them to that coffee table where they're all speaking Russian, don't you think they have a far better chance of meeting and making friends and being back there the next week? Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. And I said, if I can get one of those students to the student table where they're all sitting and talking student, I said, don't you think we have a better chance of getting them back? Uh-huh. And so if I have another university professor, don't you think if I'm getting back to your corner where you're staying with the other university professors, you know, worried about these language groups and these other groups, that they maybe have a better chance of coming back? Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. That's it. We already have these natural patterns. We just need to learn to use them. And that's why we have to be intentional about using them, because accidentally it won't always happen. Accidentally it won't always happen. I mean, the good thing is the Russian tables are into two Russian tables, you know. And these are the monolingual Russians, and plus then the bilingual Russians, I mean, they're floating around all over the place because they've been part of our church enough. I'm saying it's just things like that we have to learn to assimilate. Again, if you're in recline, you're going to be innovating at that period of time because you won't have anyone to assimilate yet. And if you're in decline, you'll just be revisioning. And again, these patterns prove the same. I mean, you can't get one of these before the other. In recline, assimilation is phase 5. In decline, it's not until phase 6. And I think this is one of the reasons sometimes people just throw up their hands and go back to the default norm. The default norm of what we've always done. Because this is going to take strategic thinking and really intentional ministry to do it. Being willing to change the way we've done things if we really expect to get different results. Now, look at page 43. There are inevitably five different components in any process of redevelopment. One is the parish, the congregation itself. It is going to be locked into a way that it's always done things. You're going to have to deal with that. You're going to have to take it seriously that you in leadership are trying to see down the road a lot further than people normally are seeing. And there's certain dynamics that have to be taken into consideration. There's the third party. If you need the outside consultant, he's another component, a driving force in this process. You have to be aware of the pastor and his own family, because they are unique in the life of the church. And the struggle and the difficulty that this can happen are caused, and also the very fact that with a pastor, with your priest, that he gets all of the blame for most of the stuff that happens, whether it's his fault or not. And the closer the parish is to closure, sometimes this is very intense, and the price that's paid by the priest and his wife and his children is immense. So they have to be understood. They're just not one family among many, but they're a particular family and with particular needs. The newcomer, that person who comes to your church, and I say still comes to your church because, you know, I think we still have that attitude towards evangelism in the OCA that, as I say, our more progressive churches say, once they find us, Father, we will welcome them. Which is sort of like going out fishing but expecting the fish to jump in the boat. No. And hopefully, once they find orthodoxy, they're well treated. But how about those others who don't even know there's orthodoxy, that would welcome them and well treat them? Not to mention those places where maybe the newcomer is not well treated, not acknowledged, not spoken to. And that's always an issue that we have to deal with. How do we deal with those newcomers in our midst? You know, someone comes up to me, oh, Father, what's that person's name over there? I don't know their name. And I just said, oh, so-and-so? I said, they've only been coming here for 3 years. Well, yeah, I haven't learned their name yet. It's sort of like the true story of the church that was in the turnaround mode. And one of the ladies of the church positioned herself to greet people as they were leaving, which is sort of interesting. She would greet them on the way out of church with these words, you know, this used to be such a nice, small, friendly church. So what was the message she was giving? Yeah, if people like you weren't showing up, we could go back to being such a nice, small, friendly church. I said it was really interesting that she was greeting people on the way out, because that's the direction she wanted to keep them going. And that's something we've got to be careful about. Because again, newcomers, unless they are just oblivious, will not fight their way in a place where they feel that they're not wanted, or not appreciated, or not valued. And even if we don't appreciate or value them, I want to tell you, Christ does. Christ does. And it's His church, not ours. And finally, the community. How does the community see you in that process of redevelopment? They might have to see you in a totally different way, and are you willing to accommodate so that they see you differently? Good example, we have a church that's an inner city church, and they had been dealt with the issues for years about whether we stay at that location or we move out into the suburbs. And I made a comment to one of the leaders in the church. I said, well, if you stay where you are, I said, you've got a lot of poor in the community. I said, you better be willing to do two things, to feed the poor in the community where you are. And two, if they want to start coming to church, you welcome them. You welcome them. I said, because the only reason you're staying where you are is because you have property there, and it's cheaper for you to stay. But I said, not one of you in your congregation, in your parish, is committed or physically attached to that location, except you found a bargain. Okay? It was a newer church that bought in a declining neighborhood. Again, if you're in a declining neighborhood, it's going to be harder to grow. Well, now that church has a ministry that provides provides food, I think, 3 or 4 days a week to the people around them in that community. People who are fed there, some that join the church. Others in that community, a lot of homeless, a lot of people who need that food to eat, survive, including children, start identifying that church not as a bunch of strangers from the suburbs who come in with a different complexion than we have, but they start identifying that church as their institution. So on a Sunday morning there, one of these fellows who's benefited from the ministry rounds up his buddies, and they patrol all the grounds around the church to make sure there are no broken whiskey bottles, which you see, you have to step over broken whiskey bottles sometimes to get into the church. It's their church now. Someone tried to break in the church. They called in 911. They started looking at it as very different because it started making a difference in their lives. And that's also key. That's also key. So I'm saying that's the price you pay. And there's going to be a price paid in every one of these components. The congregation as a whole, the pastor, the third party, the community, these are all people who are going to be involved in this. And if the community doesn't associate with you somehow as something that might have something for them, then again, it's your responsibility to change that attitude. Let's go to page 4-5. The greater the decline that you've discovered in your church, there's going to be the greater demand for closure. And the greater the decline, the greater the demand for entrepreneurial skill. And remember, an entrepreneur normally can do a number of things well, and it's going to take that type of leadership to move it forward. Understand that the greater the decline in a community, the greater the presence of a survivalist mentality. In other words, the community has needs which the church meets. That's in a healthy church. But in survivalism, the church has needs which it expects the community to meet. And that can even be from the fundraisers it has to keep its doors open. Right? Put another way, the reach perspective, the concern for reaching the lost has been replaced by concern for losing the reach. Sometimes this comes back to haunt the priest. Oh, Father, you can't upset so-and-so because we just have a few people anyway. And sometimes all Father's doing is preaching the gospel. See? So we'll hold on no matter what that price is. The greater the decline, the greater evidence of negativity. And this is part of, you're going to probably resonate with some of these things. What's evidence of negativity and decline in churches? There's a number of things. Anger is one. Sometimes you can just tell it. In a declining church community, there's a lot of anger. There can be depression. Mistrust. Normally a lot of argumentation in the negative, in the declining community. You can get into arguments over all sorts of things, like the color of towels that you put in the church kitchen or something. You'll argue antagonism. Just general spirit of antagonism in the declining church. Indecision. Declining churches have a hard time making decisions. Procrastination. Declining churches have a hard time getting jobs done. They put things off, even sometimes the obvious. And why? It leads to the next denial. There's just a lot of denial that the things are really as bad as people think it, they are. Oh, it's not really that bad. There can be a spirit of helplessness in the declining church. Gee, what do we do? We don't know what to do. We've tried everything we know. Well, okay. Sometimes we have to look beyond what we know. There can be a spirit of desperation. There can be hostility towards one another, towards outsiders, towards the community. That can be balanced off by a sort of elitism. even within the declining community, many times there's a superior, well, there are those, the elite, who really control everything, and then the rest of us who don't know what's going on. There could be that spirit, because again, you're not having all things in common, and a single spirit of purpose. There can be a spirit of separatism that maybe, well, we're not really a part of the diocese. You know, what does the diocese do for us? We're not really part of the OCA. What does the OCA do for us? That's normally always a sign of negativity and decline when people take on those attitudes. And there can be a spirit of just of prejudice, and just not in prejudice in the way we think of prejudice. We normally think of that in racial times, but it certainly can be there. But it can also be just a prejudicial way of looking at life. It can be like, we've tried that before, and it didn't work. So we're prejudiced to ever have it mentioned again. And the thing is, maybe it didn't work because it wasn't the right time, or maybe it didn't work because you didn't do the right things, or whatever. But in a declining institution, those attitudes just take hold. And so those have to be addressed. Those have to be addressed. But normally there's a cause for it as well. And you have to look at the cause. Let's move on to 5:1. I think you've seen by now that somewhere along the line, to address decline in your church, you're going to have to deal with the vision question. We looked about it a little bit earlier, about this is really trying to see what God's vision is for your future, not your opinions. And that God has really revealed something about that, because it will involve the Great Commission, and it will involve those key descriptors of church life we find in the book of Acts, of being faithful, continuing steadfast in the apostles' teaching, fellowship, the breaking of bread, and prayers, having all things in common. To start that process, here's a question you need to ask yourself. How does God want to express himself through this church and this community at this time? That's the question all of you need to go back to your parishes and say, how does God want to express himself through this church and this community at this time? Because it's really key. The founders of our churches knew that and could tell you that when they founded these churches. And maybe they didn't use that terminology. But they were convinced that they struggled, and they had to make the sacrifices, and they put up sometimes a humble structure, but so that a greater edifice could be erected in the future, but that for their generations to come, that God might be worshipped in an orthodox manner on that site. They really did. They really did. And to ask yourself these questions, and first of all, in terms of your own values, who are you? Not what you should be, but first of all, you have to ask yourself, who are you right now? And I'll tell you, the greatest way to find out who you are as a parish is to look at how you spend your time as a parish and how you spend your money. The Lord said, where a man's heart is, there will his treasure be also. Your parish budgets will reflect where you spend your treasure and what you spend it on. Okay? Your parish calendars will tell you what you value about your time together. And will you be involved in a lot of busy things? Were you involved in things that really spread the kingdom? Remember, it was Mary and Martha was busy in the kitchen. And she said, well, if my sister wouldn't spend as much time sitting at your feet, Lord, get her in here to help me. Because after all, this is more important for her as a woman to be doing. See, it's something, when you say that someone sat at someone's feet meant you were their disciple, and that was never said about women in that culture. But it was said in the scripture about Mary of Bethany. In other words, she had become a disciple in the same sense.
new. They were in their learning.
Her sister
Martha, good old practical Martha, said, "Nana, get back out here in the kitchen. She's got to help me. We've got all this food to cook for all you people." You see, sometimes we are a lot more like Martha than Mary, men and women. And we're not spending the time together we need to grow as Christian disciples. And the Lord said, "You know, Martha, you're troubled about a lot of things." It says, Mary's chose something better. She chose something better. And we're not going to take that anymore. He never said, "You don't need to be in the kitchen." We always need the people in the kitchen. We do. But it's our sense of priority of what we do. And is it just busyness and busy work? You notice that even when Lazarus dies, don't you, about Martha? She says, "Lord, if you had been here, if you had been here, in other words, you would have done something and he wouldn't have died." That's Martha. And Mary is at the tomb. It's very interesting to see those two ladies and those two attitudes, but we all have to face those things. And in our own parish life, what are we spending our time doing? I said when I went to State College, our first obligation together, we had to be a community that knew how to pray together. That had to be our first obligation. It wasn't anything else that we did, because if we couldn't pray together, then what kind of Christian community were we? In other words, worship was going to be the number one thing on the agenda. And everything else could flow out of that. Two, our target. Who are we trying to reach? Remember, you will reach targets successively if you keep your vision. I came in and challenged the congregation, the parish, to reach college students and then families with young children. And now you can name umpteen different people groups that we try to reach in various ways. We couldn't start all those at one time. But we had definite ideas about who we were sent there to reach and would focus our effort. And we wouldn't add new ministries until we had another one up and running. Three, how are we going to reach them? Well, depending on if you reach college students with, as Father Peter Gilchrist used to say, pizza. That's the key to successful campus ministry. It's not what you're teaching, it's what you're feeding them. Feed them. They'll come. You can do something with them if they show up. How are you going to reach them? Actually, that's the way Jesus taught. Jesus taught over food. There was a crowd that had come, they'd gathered, there were 5,000 men, plus the women and children, and the apostle said, "Lord, they're hungry, let's send them home." Don't the apostles kind of sound like sometimes our approach in churches, right? All these people are showing up, let's send them home. What are we going to do? The Lord said, "Send them down. We've only got 2 loaves of barley bread and 5 fishes. Sit them down. Bless, break, give. Now pick up the remnants. 12 baskets full." The Lord taught in the same way. He taught over food. That's why we worship over food too, brethren. We come together, we gather together, we come to the Lord's table, and then we're sent home. We're not sent home without having been fed. And that's how we do ministry with people. Because if we will have food with someone else, we enter into a relationship with the person that's across the table from us. That's the very meaning of the word companion, the person we have shared bread with. When we go down to the homeless shelter, not only has our parish cooked the food that night, so the people aren't just having to survive on whatever the canned goods there, and the men, women, and children in our homeless shelter. But one thing, the feedback we got was, yours is the only church that sits down and eats with the people in the homeless shelter. And I thought, well, how else could we minister to the people in the homeless shelter unless we sit down and eat with the people that we're ministering to? Because these just aren't amorphous people that were dropping off the food and let them handle for themselves. These are people who need a sense of dignity and respect restored in their lives. And how is that going to happen unless we church people are there sitting there at the table with the same folks eating dinner with them?